Chapter 25. Fell sick, and the soldiers who were sick died miserably, and the noble army of Prince Bull perished. When the dismal news of his great loss was carried to the prince, he suspected his godmother very much indeed, but he knew that his servants must have kept company with the malicious beldam, and must have given way to her, and therefore he resolved to turn those servants out of their places. So, he called to him a roebuck who had the gift of speech, and he said, "Good roebuck, tell them they must go." Apostrophe so, the good roebuck delivered his message, so like a man, that you might have supposed him to be nothing but a man, and they were turned out, but, not without warning, for that they had had a long time. And now comes the most extraordinary part of the history of this prince. When he had turned out those servants, of course he wanted others. What was his astonishment to find that in all his dominions, which contained no less than 27 millions of people, there were not above 25 servants altogether. They were so lofty about it too, that instead of discussing whether they should hire themselves as servants to Prince Bull, they turned things topsy-turvy, and considered whether as a favor they should hire Prince Bull to be their master. While they were arguing this point among themselves quite at their leisure, the wicked old red fairy was incessantly going up and down, knocking at the doors of 12 of the oldest of the 25, who were the oldest inhabitants in all that country, and whose united ages amounted to 1,000, saying, "Will you hire Prince Bull for your master? Will you hire Prince Bull for your master?" Apostrophe to which one answered, "I will if next door will." Apostrophe and another, "I won't if over the way does." Apostrophe and another, "I can't if he, she, or they, might, could, would, or should." Apostrophe and all this time Prince Bull's affairs were going to rack and ruin. At last, Prince Bull, in the height of his perplexity, assumed a thoughtful face, as if he were struck by an entirely new idea. The wicked old fairy, seeing this, was at his elbow directly, and said, "How do you do, my prince, and what are you thinking of?" Apostrophe apostrophe "I am thinking, godmother," apostrophe says he, "that among all the 27 millions of my subjects who have never been in service, there are men of intellect and business who have made me very famous both among my friends and enemies." Apostrophe "I, truly?" Apostrophe says the fairy. "Aye, truly," apostrophe says the prince. "And what then?" Apostrophe says the fairy. "Why then," apostrophe says he, "since the regular old class of servants do so ill, are so hard to get, and carry it with so high a hand, perhaps I might try to make good servants of some of these." Apostrophe the words had no sooner passed his lips than she returned, chuckling, "You think so, do you? Indeed, my prince? Tape." Apostrophe thereupon he directly forgot what he was thinking of, and cried out lamentably to the old servants, "Oh, do come and hire your poor old master. Pray do. On any terms." Apostrophe and this, for the present, finishes the story of Prince Bull. I wish I could wind it up by saying that he lived happy ever afterwards, but I cannot in my conscience do so. For, with Tape at his elbow, and his estranged children fatally repelled by her from coming near him, I do not, to tell you the plain truth, believe in the possibility of such an end to it. A plated article, putting up for the night in one of the chiefest towns of Staffordshire, I find it to be by no means a lively town. In fact, it is as dull and dead a town as anyone could desire not to see. It seems as if its whole population might be imprisoned in its railway station. The refreshment room at that station is a vortex of dissipation compared with the extinct town inn, the Dodo, in the dull High Street. Why High Street? Why not rather Low Street, Flat Street, Low-Spirited Street, Used-Up Street? Where are the people who belong to the High Street? Can they all be dispersed over the face of the country, seeking the unfortunate strolling manager who decamped from the moldy little theater last week, in the beginning of his season, as his playbills testify, repentantly resolved to bring him back, and feed him, and be entertained? Or, And they all be gathered to their fathers, in the two old churchyards near to the High Street retirement, and to which churchyards appears to be a mere ceremony. There is so very little life outside their confines, and such small discernible difference between being buried alive in the town, and buried dead in the town tombs. Over the way, opposite to the staring blank bow windows of the Dodo, are a little ironmonger's shop, a little tailor's shop with a picture of the fashions in the small window, and a bandy-legged baby on the pavement staring at it, a watchmaker's shop, where all the clocks and watches must be stopped, I am sure, for they could never have the courage to go, with the town in general, and the Dodo in particular, looking at them. Shade of Miss Linwood, erst of Leicester Square, London, thou art welcome here, and thy retreat is fitly chosen. I myself was one of the last visitors to that awful storehouse of thy life's work, where an anchorite old man and woman took my shilling with a solemn wonder, and conducting me to a gloomy sepulchre of needlework dropping to pieces with dust, and agent shrouded in twilight at high noon, left me there, chilled, frightened, and alone. And now, in ghostly letters on all the dead walls of this dead town, I read thy honored name, and find that thy last supper, worked in Berlin wool, invites inspection as a powerful excitement. Where are the people who are bidden with so much cry to this feast of little wool? Where are they? Who are they? They are not the bandy-legged baby studying the fashions in the tailor's window. They are not the two earthy plowmen lounging outside the saddler's shop, in the stiff square, where the town hall stands, like a brick-and-mortar private on parade. They are not the landlady of the Dodo in the empty bar, whose I had trouble in it and no welcome, when I asked for dinner. They are not the turnkeys of the town jail, looking out of the gateway in their uniforms, as if they had locked up all the balance, as my American friends would say, of the inhabitants, and could now rest a little. They are not the two moldy millers in the white mill down by the river, where the great water wheel goes heavily round and round, like the monotonous days and nights in this forgotten place. Then who are they, for there is no one else? No. This deponent maketh oath and saith, that there is no one else, save and except the waiter at the Dodo, now laying the cloth. I have paced the streets, and stared at the houses, and am come back to the blank bow window of the Dodo, and the town clocks strike 7, and the reluctant echoes seem to cry, "Don't wake us!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and the bandy-legged baby has gone home to bed. If the Dodo were only a gregarious bird, if he had only some confused idea of making a comfortable nest, I could hope to get through the hours between this and bedtime, without being consumed by devouring melancholy. But, the Dodo's habits are all wrong. It provides me with a trackless desert of sitting room, with a chair for every day in the year, a table for every month, and a waste of sideboard, where a lonely china vase pines in a corner for its mate long departed, and will never make a match with the candlestick in the opposite corner, if it live till doomsday. The Dodo has nothing in the larder. Even now, I behold the boots returning with my soul in a piece of paper, and with that portion of my dinner, the boots, perceiving me at the blank bow window, slaps his leg as he comes across the road, pretending it is something else. The Dodo excludes the outer air. When I mount up to my bedroom, a smell of closeness and flu gets lazily up my nose like sleepy snuff. The loose little bits of carpet writhe under my tread, and take wormy shapes. I don't know the ridiculous man in the looking glass, beyond having met him once or twice in a dish cover, and I can never shave him tomorrow morning. The Dodo is narrow-minded as to towels. Expects me to wash on a Freemason's apron without the trimming. When I asked for soap, gives me a stony-hearted something white, with no more lather in it than the Elgin marbles. The Dodo has seen better days, and possesses interminable stables at the back, silent, grass-grown, broken-windowed, horseless. This mournful bird can fry a sole, however, which is much. Can cook a steak too, which is more. I wonder where it gets its sherry? If I were to send my pint of wine to some famous chemist to be analyzed, What would it turn out to be made of? It tastes of pepper, sugar, bitter almonds, vinegar, warm knives, any flat drinks, and a little brandy. Would it unman a Spanish exile by reminding him of his native land at all? I think not. If there really be any townspeople out of the churchyards, and if a caravan of them ever do dine, with a bottle of wine per man, in this desert of the Dodo, it must make good for the doctor next day. Where was the waiter born? How did he come here? Has he any hope of getting away from here? Does he ever receive a letter, or take a ride upon the railway, or see anything but the Dodo? Perhaps he has seen the Berlin Wall. He appears to have a silent sorrow on him, and it may be that. He clears the table, draws the dingy curtains of the great bow window, which so unwillingly consent to meet, that they must be pinned together, leaves me by the fire with my pint decanter, and a little thin funnel-shaped wine glass, and a plate of pale biscuits, in themselves engendering desperation. No book, no newspaper. I left the Arabian Nights in the railway carriage, and have nothing to read but Bradshaw, and that way madness lies. Apostrophe remembering what prisoners and shipwrecked mariners have done to exercise their minds in solitude, I repeat the multiplication table, the pence table, and the shilling table, which are all the tables I happen to know. What if I write something? The Dodo keeps no pens but steel pens. And those I always stick through the paper, and can turn to no other account. What am I to do? Even if I could have the bandy-legged baby knocked up and brought here, I could offer him nothing but sherry, and that would be the death of him. He would never hold up his head again, if he touched it. I can't go to bed, because I have conceived a mortal hatred for my bedroom. And I can't go away, because there is no train for my place of destination until morning. To burn the biscuits will be but a fleeting joy, still it is a temporary relief, and here they go on the fire. Shall I break the plate? First let me look at the back, and see who made it. Copeland. Copeland. Stop a moment. Was it yesterday I visited Copeland's works, and saw them making plates? In the confusion of traveling about, it might be yesterday, or it might be yesterday month, but I think it was yesterday. I appeal to the plate. The plate says, decidedly, yesterday. I find the plate, as I look at it, growing into a companion. Don't you remember, says the plate, how you steamed away, yesterday morning, in the bright sun and the east wind, along the valley of the sparkling Trent? Don't you recollect how many kilns you flew past, looking like the bowls of gigantic tobacco pipes, cut short off from the stem and turned upside down? And the fires and the smoke, and the roads made with bits of crockery, as if all the plates and dishes in the civilized world had been macadamized, expressly for the laming of all the horses? Of course I do. And don't you remember, says the plate, how you alighted at Stoke, a picturesque heap of houses, kilns, smoke, wharfs, canals, and river, lying, as was most appropriate, in a basin, and how, after climbing up the sides of the basin, to look at the prospect, you trundled down again at a walking match pace, and straight proceeded to my father's, Copeland's, where the whole of my family, high and low, rich and poor, are turned out upon the world from our nursery and seminary, covering some 14 acres of ground? And don't you remember what we spring from? Heaps of lumps of clay, partially prepared and cleaned in Devonshire and Dorsetshire, whence said clay principally comes, and hills of flint, without which we should want our ringing sound, and should never be musical? And as to the flint, don't you recollect, that it is first burned in kilns, and is then laid under the 4 iron feet of a demon slave, subject to violent stamping fits, who, when they come on, stamps away insanely with his 4 iron legs, and would crush all the flint in the Isle of Thanet to powder, without leaving off? And as to the clay, don't you recollect how it is put in 2 mills or teasers, and is sliced, and dug, and cut at, by endless knives, clogged and sticky, but persistent, and is pressed out of that machine through a square trough, whose form it takes, and is cut off in square lumps, and thrown into a vat, and there mixed with water, and beaten to a pulp by paddle wheels, and is then run into a rough house, all rugged beams and ladders splashed with white, superintended by Grindoff the miller in his working clothes, all splashed with white, where it passes through no end of machinery moved sieves all. Splashed with white, arranged in an ascending scale of fineness, some so fine, that 300 silk threads cross each other in a single square inch of their surface, and all in a violent state of ago with their teeth forever chattering, and their bodies forever shivering. And as to the flint again, isn't it mashed and mollified and troubled and soothed, exactly as rags are in a paper mill, until it is reduced to a pap so fine, that it contains no atom of grit perceptible to the nicest taste? And as to the flint and the clay together, are they not, after all this, mixed in the proportion of 5 of clay to 1 of flint, and isn't the compound known as slip run into oblong troughs, where its superfluous moisture may evaporate? And finally, isn't it slapped and banged and beaten, and patted and kneaded and wedged and knocked about like butter, until it becomes a beautiful gray dough, ready for the potter's use? In regard of the potter, popularly so called, says the plate, you don't mean to say you have forgotten that a workman called a thrower is the man under whose hand this gray dough takes the shapes of the simpler household vessels as quickly as the eye can follow? You don't mean to say you cannot call him up before you, sitting, with his attendant woman, at his potter's wheel a disc about the size of a dinner plate, revolving on 2 drums slowly or quickly as he wills, who made you a complete breakfast set for a bachelor, as a good-humored little off-hand joke? You remember how he took up as much dough as he wanted, and, throwing it on his wheel, in a moment fashioned it into a teacup, caught up more clay, and made a saucer a larger dab, and whirled it into a teapot, winked at a smaller dab, and converted it into the lid of the teapot, accurately fitting by the measurement of his eye alone, coaxed a middle-sized dab for 2 seconds, broke it, turned it over at the rim, and made a milk pot laughed, and turned out a slop basin coughed, and provided for the sugar? Neither, I think, are you oblivious of the newer mode of making various articles, but especially basins, according to which improvement a mold revolves instead of a disc? For you must remember, says the plate, how you saw the mold of a little basin spinning round and round, and how the workman smoothed, and pressed a handful of dough upon it, and how with an instrument, called a profile, a piece of wood, representing the profile of a basin's foot, he cleverly scraped and carved the ring which makes the base of any such basin, and then took the basin off the lathe like a doughy skull cap to be dried, and afterwards, in what is called a green state, to be put into a second lathe, there to be finished and burnished with a steel burnisher? And as to molding in general, says the plate, it can't be necessary for me to remind you that all ornamental articles, and indeed all articles not quite circular, are made in molds. For you must remember how you saw the vegetable dishes, for example, being made in molds, and how the handles of teacups, and the spouts of teapots, and the feet of tureens, and so forth, are all made in little separate molds, and are each stuck onto the body corporate, of which it is destined to form a part, with a stuff called slag, apostrophe as quickly as you can recollect it. Further, you learnt, you know you did in the same visit, how the beautiful sculptures in the delicate new material called Parian, are all constructed in molds, how, into that material, animal bones are ground up, because the phosphate of lime contained in bones makes it translucent, how everything is molded, before going into the fire, 1/4 larger than it is intended to come out of the fire, because it shrinks in that proportion in the intense heat, how, when a figure shrinks unequally, it is spoiled emerging from the furnace a misshapen birth, a big head and a little body, or a little head and a big body, or a Quasimodo with long arms and short legs, or a Miss Biffin with neither legs nor arms worth mentioning. And as to the kilns, in which the firing takes place, and in which some of the more precious articles are burned repeatedly, in various Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.